suspended. And we become...
what's the word? We become sort of like totally immobilized. Suspended animation, that's what it's compared to. Just stopped. Everything stopped. Because, see, you're still in the dreaming state. You're still receiving karma. Oh, in deep sleep. It may have some similarity. Nothing much is going on. Nothing much is going on. Karma means that the Yamadutas, they cannot figure out what to do with you because you've been so sinful. They're having a big conference, what to do with this one. So it's a different type of situation. There's a theory that sometimes the soul leaves the body in dream states and goes to those places, and there's some silver cord or something which connects us, and if somehow one is awoken in a very like abrupt way, then that connection may be broken. You know, that's not referred to in Srimad Bhagavatam, so I don't think we really need to worry about that. It's more like Lobsang Rampa, if you've heard about him. It's more like the pseudo-Western spiritualists. They're into that sort of thing, like astral traveling and stuff like that. I don't think we really need to worry about it too much. We take it, generally, as Pipalayana says, that some impressions built up during the day or over a period of time even, they kind of are situated around the false ego. The rest of the mind is basically shut off. Yeah. But not totally. There's just these sort of remnants there. So therefore, on the basis of false ego, there's still a basis of me, the same me there. But you have all these kind of fragmented experiences and dreams. Generally, you know, not very complete, not very clear, often severely disjointed, sometimes bizarre and crazy. You know, it's like that. Because when you're sleeping, you're in tamagun. What do you expect? To wake you up from deep sleep? Well, I don't know. It may be, you know, if your karma has been sort of, has slowed down significantly while you're in deep sleep. But then your karma may start again, or, you know, some reaction comes. And that stimulates you back into consciousness, possibly something like that. Okay, now look, for tomorrow, actually we make good. Jai Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So yesterday we talked about the jiva. First of all, actually, we talked about how the absolute truth or the highest truth is supreme consciousness, absolute consciousness. And the objections of the Buddhists, who say there is no real consciousness, ultimately there's just a void, or the highest truth is a void, that was shown to be false. And particularly it was shown to be false by taking different statements from Srimad Bhagavatam, which we have accepted now. We have already accepted it as our source of knowledge. So therefore, it is not just because the Buddhists may object, doesn't mean that we now start questioning, should we accept what Srimad Bhagavatam says on the subject or not? No. We know that now we've accepted the Bhagavatam, so we just therefore refer to the Bhagavatam, and we find that the Bhagavatam gives quite a different picture from what the Buddhists think about consciousness, the absolute truth, non-dual consciousness like this. So, first of all then, that point was made, that the absolute truth is non-dual consciousness. Then various verses were quoted from Shruti, showed that the same absolute truth, along being non-dual consciousness, it is the source of everything, including it is the source of the jiva. And then tat-tvamasi, through that, the understanding of that verse, you are that, then we saw that actually we, the jivas, we have certain things in common with the absolute truth, particularly that we are conscious, we're eternal, conscious, living entities. Of course, we're very small, and the absolute truth is unlimited, but at least we do definitely share those characteristics. So then, in order to help us to understand this absolute truth who is non-dual consciousness, then two verses were quoted from the 11th canto, in which the consciousness of the jiva was analyzed. The consciousness of the jiva in terms of the different experiences that we undergo, in terms of our bodies, or at least the birth, growth, and ultimately the death of our body, either this one or the many that we have in different species. And how we are just witnessing, we are just observing all the changes that are going on around us, and the apparent changes in consciousness are just changes of state of mind. When the mind is exposed to different situations, then the mind, state of mind changes, but the fundamental factor of consciousness remains the same. And then at the end, so there were four arguments in that regard. There are four arguments which could, each of which could be applied in a negative sense or in a positive sense to show that the soul was not like that changing, fluctuating body, or to show so the soul is not like that, or to show that the soul is something, it is constant. In other words, it is eternal and blissful like that. Although at this point in time, of course, the fourth argument was that at this point in time, because we have these bodies and we are entangled, therefore, even though we are pure consciousness and we're also blissful and eternal like the absolute consciousness, but because we're entangled, therefore we're suffering here, being implicated by our involvement in this world and involvement with these bodies. But the Supreme Personality of Godhead, He is never like that. He's always blissful, always ecstatic, always independent of the material nature. And then that last verse, which in fact was not quoted, but it immediately follows on from the two which were quoted, that last verse, 11.3.40, explained clearly that when we link up with that Supreme Soul through devotional service and our lives become purified, everything becomes purified, then we become liberated, we become blissful, just like the sun, just like the sun is very, what did it say? Just as one can directly experience the sunshine when one has healthy vision. Yes. So one's position becomes healthy and happy like that. So in these ways, through studying the nature of the soul, we got some insight into the nature of the Supreme Soul, Supreme Personality of Godhead. So now we're on page 76, and we're going into the last section, section 7, which is the third part of this premier section. It is the third part of the section which is explaining what is the knowledge that Srimad Bhagavatam is giving. How does Srimad Bhagavatam see the absolute truth? How does it explain? What is the relationship, in other words, between the Bhagavatam and its subject, the absolute truth? So now this is the third section, and that means it is the third perspective, you could say. The third perspective on the absolute truth. Because we're defining now. We're defining. So we got a definition from the realizations of Vyas and Shukadev. We've got some sort of definition through understanding the jiva and the jiva's consciousness. So now we're going to get a third type of definition. And it's a very powerful definition, actually. This is a definition of the absolute truth, or that subject matter of Srimad Bhagavatam, in terms of its position amongst the 10 topics that the Srimad Bhagavatam is made up of, because it is a Mahapurana, and it is standard for a Mahapurana to have 10 topics. And so Srimad Bhagavatam certainly does. And it very exhaustively, actually, goes into all 10 of the topics. It discusses all 10 of the topics at great length and very precisely and very clearly in detail. And including the 10th topic, who is that same absolute truth, who is the shelter of everything, as we have heard, we just heard from those Shruti verses. And there was the implication from Vyasa's realization also that absolute truth, that supreme truth, which is the final subject matter of Srimad Bhagavatam, that is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the shelter, ashraya, the shelter of everyone and everything. So this is what is going to be discussed here in this section 7. Just, we could also mention that there are 3 subsections here. The first one you can see there on page 76, that Shukadev Goswami, he lists out the 10 topics. So that's the first subsection, verses 56 to 58. Then from verses 59 and 60, they are particularly focusing on the 10th topic, the shelter, the absolute truth, who is the shelter of all shelters, and who is his own shelter, and who is not sheltered by anyone else. Yeah. So that is part of Shukadev's description, actually. But then there is a third subsection, which is verses 61 to 63. And there, Suta Goswami also lists out the 10 topics and also makes the same point about the 10th topic, who is the absolute truth, the ashraya. Actually does it in a slightly different way. His terminology is a little different, but Jiva Goswami explains that despite that, he's talking about the same things. The 10 topics are the same. Okay, so let us now go into it, starting with text 56, 56.1. So he first of all recaps a little bit, discussing, just going back over what we discussed yesterday about the jivas and how understanding them helps us to understand the Supreme Brahman. And then he goes into the 10 topics. So, 56.1. By describing these characteristics of the jiva souls, whose inner nature is pure consciousness, we have, in effect, described the Supreme Brahman, the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam, from the individual or Vyashti, viewpoint. That means, I mentioned the other day, one of the days, about, maybe even yesterday, microcosm and macrocosm. You know what I mean by that? Yeah, you can understand the ocean by taking one drop of water from it. You can understand a gold mine by taking one piece, small piece of gold. This sort of idea. You can understand humanity by understanding one human. This sort of idea. How you can understand a greater thing by understanding some smaller thing which is truly representative, part and parcel, and in that way truly representative of the greater thing. So this is what he means by that we have, therefore, by using the jivas, we have actually, in the end, we have actually described the supreme Brahman, but from that Vyashti viewpoint. This is so because the supreme Brahman is non-different from the jiva souls, being the complete whole from whom they emanate in the form of his individual partial expansions. Indeed, he is called the Ashraya, the fountainhead of all existence. Well, Ashraya, generally we hear Ashraya translated as meaning shelter. But shelter in this very complete and very absolute, all-inclusive sense, it includes being the fountainhead also, being the source. Yeah. For something to be the ultimate shelter means it's the source. There's no shelter beyond. It also includes being the source, the fountainhead of all existence. The same non-dual reality, Brahman, is also characterized in aggregate, or samashti, cosmic terms, in the list of a major Purana's 10 topics, beginning with primary creation. This list is given in the following two verses, so we'll read that, the following two verses in a second or two, but this is the idea here, that we have looked at the absolute truth from the bottom up, you could say, from the jiva, small little fragment up to that great, how the jiva gives us insight into that great, unlimited, conscious entity, the supreme Brahman. So now we're going to look, you could say, more or less, on his own level, on the complete level. We're going to look on that level, the higher level of actually going directly into the nature of that absolute, straight into it, not just indirectly. So the procedure will be through understanding the 10 topics. And this is very interesting. The 10 topics, of course, one of them, the last one, is that absolute truth. And the point is, one of the main points is that the other 9, they're not just another 9 and he happens to be the 10th. But the other 9 are irrevocably linked with him. And when we see how the Srimad Bhagavatam, when it's discussing one other of those 9 topics, but we see how that discussion reflects on the absolute truth. So it's all connecting up and helping us to understand the magnitude and nature of that absolute truth. So let us read now. There are two verses quoted here from 2nd Canto, chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. This is where you find the 10 topics as described by Shukadev. And then he elaborates on them in the following verses, which we'll also read. So Shukadev says, this Srimad Bhagavatam describes 10 subjects, Sarga, or primary creation. If you want a little insight into our test, we're going to ask you for these 10 topics. So that's something you can swat up tonight. Sarga, this is an order from 1 to 10. First of all, Sarga, the primary creation. Then Visarga, the secondary creation. You may, if you recall, do you recall the five subjects of a regular Purana? Now, they only had creation. It was not the two aspects. The second was dissolution. Yeah. But here, because this is now a Mahapurana, this is a greater literature, then it is describing the primary creation from the Lord, and then the secondary creation, which basically means the creation from Brahma. Okay, so that's the first two. Then, third is sthana, or sometimes it's called sthiti, which means maintenance or protection, raksha. When Sutta Goswami lists them out, he says raksha, protection. So maintenance, protection, which if you think about it, you'll see they're basically the same thing, really. Fourth is poshana. Poshana means mercy. And who is he merciful to? He's merciful to the devotees. Or, where is the mercy going? It's going to the devotees. Uti is, what is that? That's now the fifth one. That means desire. Actually, it means material desire. Fruit of desire. Then the sixth one, Manvantara. Now that was also one of the five of a regular Purana. So Manvantara means, well anyway, he's going to explain in the following verses what is included within that. Then Ishanu Kata, the pastimes of the Lord and his devotees. Then number eight, Nirodha, the annihilation. How everything is wound up back into Mahavishnu. Then ninth, mukti, or liberation. And tenth, that absolute truth, that final main subject, which is the goal and the whole point of Srimad Bhagavatam, the ashraya, who is the substratum, or you could say the summum bonum. He is sustaining everything. He is that absolute reality referred to in one of the previous verses. If you remember, there were three aspects to his absoluteness. That he is the shelter of, he has energies and he interacts with them, but they are totally dependent upon him. So therefore he is the substratum in that sense, summum bonum, the be-all and end-all, and the ultimate shelter of everything, even including himself. Yeah. So, now, interesting point is now made here in the last sentence here. To clarify the meaning of the tenth subject, the great souls describe the characteristics of the first nine subjects by prayers and also by indirect and direct explanations. In other words, in all sorts of ways, actually. In all sorts of ways. Through these nine, the first nine, the tenth is always the focal point. As we said, it's not that the first nine are just nine and they're just standing independently of the tenth and of each other, and the tenth is just another one, it just happens to be the tenth. No, those nine are always discussed in so many ways, in the form of pastimes, in the form of prayers, in the form of philosophical discussions, directly, indirectly, in all sorts of ways. Those first nine are always addressing the tenth. They're not just talking about, you know, some other unrelated thing. So you get the idea. This is a very powerful argument being presented by Jiva Goswami. Okay, so now let's see what happens. 56.2. he gives a little elaboration on a couple of them before, in 57 and 58, particularly 57, before going into more detailed description of each, through which we can appreciate how the nine, the first nine, are actually simply there to point out the tenth. Okay, 56.2. Manvantaresh Anukata is a compound of manvantara, periods of manu, and ishanukata. Just a grammatical point, really. This Srimad Bhagavatam describes 10 topics beginning with creation, but the sage's real purpose in describing the characteristics of the first nine is to give us systematic, lucid knowledge of the 10th topic. That's all. That's what the first nine are there for, not just as independent topics. One might object here that the presentation of the other nine topics does not seem to explain the 10th topic. Well, you would only really say that if you haven't read Srimad Bhagavatam, because if you have, you would see that they do actually do that. So we reply that in the Bhagavatam, the sages explain the 10th topic both directly by the explicit utterance of prayers and other statements, and also indirectly through the implied purport of various historical accounts. So there are many stories. There's a number of stories in Srimad Bhagavatam, but they're not just stories. They may have seemed to be just stories, but actually they're stories which imply the ashraya, and they elucidate, they help us to understand from different perspectives that 10th topic, the ashraya. All right, so let us go into 57 then. To elucidate the 10th subject, Sri Shukadeva Goswami speaks 7 verses defining each of the 10 subjects. So, 4 of the 7 verses are as follows, that's true. Anyway, yeah, in 57 he's going to present 4 of them. These four describe the first 9. Subjects. Then the 5th of these 7 introduces the 10th subject, and the 6th and 7th of the 7 in a very kind of, well, it's a very interesting way. They explain, point out that very special position of the 10th as the shelter, supreme shelter. But for the time being, 57 is going to, Jiva Goswami is going to explain, he's going to quote these 4 verses describing the first 9 and explain them a bit. So, beginning with 2.10.3, so this is the very next verse from the Bhagavatam, after these 2 verses which just briefly list them out. So Shukadeva Goswami says, the primary creation of the 5 gross elements, the 5 subtle sense objects, the 5 senses, the mahatattva and the false ego, resulting from the disturbance in the material mode's equilibrium caused by the Supreme Lord, is known as Sarga. So that is all happening from Mahavishnu, isn't it? And we know the descriptions are there in the Bhagavatam of this whole process, in terms of how it originates within Lord Vishnu. And he glances, and so on and so forth. So the first topic then is very much connected with the 10th topic, the Supreme Lord, the ultimate reality. It's very much helping us to understand the nature of that 10th topic. Then the secondary creation affected by Lord Brahma is called Visarga. Well, there is a clear description of how Lord Brahma comes out of the navel of Vishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. And then he's trying to figure out what to do. He can't, so he climbs down the, starts climbing down the stem of the lotus, and then Lord Vishnu, that same absolute truth, speaks to him and instructs him. And then as a result, he takes up a certain process of meditation, and then he realizes what to do, how to carry out the secondary creation, and he does it. So the second topic, it also clarifies further our understanding of this 10th topic, and in important details, not just in a vague sense, but by going into detail about how the Lord is functioning. Okay, then he continues on over the page by just elaborating so we know what these various elements are. The Bhutas mentioned here are the five gross material elements, beginning with ether and finishing with earth, from subtle to gross. The matras are the subtle elements, sound and so on, sound, sight and all that. The indriyas are the perceptive senses. The word D, intelligence, indicates the totality of unmanifest matter, together with false ego. Brahman, the supreme controller, generates these physical and non-physical elements by causing the modes of material nature to become unbalanced and produce transformations. So he is just helping us to understand there how the Saraga, first primary creation, creative process, is very much based on the Lord. And when we understand it, then we are naturally understanding how the Lord's functioning. So this is called Saraga or creation. The secondary creation by Lord Brahma is called Visaraga. Since he is the Vairaja Purusha or universal person, his creation is also called Purusha. Visaraga is the sending forth of moving and non-moving living beings. So that's just a little background information, basically. Then 57.2, he starts discussing. We've discussed two now of the nine, so he's going to discuss some more. And this is, he quotes Srimad Bhagavatam 2.10, verses 4 and 5. Stiti. Now, actually in the list, it's sthana. So, anyway, that's okay. It's the same thing. Stiti means, or sthana, which is maintenance or protection. It is the victory of Lord Vishnu. And poshana is the grace he bestows on his devotees. The word manvantara indicates the principles of transcendental religion, while Uti refers to desires for material activities. Ishanukata indicates the various descriptions of the Lord's pastimes in his incarnations and also the descriptions of his faithful devotees' activities. So then he elaborates. It's pretty self-evident, really. Stiti, or maintenance, or protection, sthana, is Vaikuntha Vijaya, the victory of Lord Vaikuntha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, stiti indicates the supreme glory of the Lord, shown by his maintaining all created beings in their respective situations under his law. So there are passages about that sort of thing, and how he protects his devotees. Poshanam, sustenance, indicates how he maintains his devotees by bestowing his grace on them, like Prahlad Maharaj, like Maharaj Bharat, like the cowherd boys in the 10th canto. Manvantarani, periods of Manus, indicates the histories of the Manus, like Swayambhuva Manu. He's described. He's the father of Devahuti. So, that description of how Swayambhuva Manu approached Karadama, and, you know, how Kapila appeared, and this is all part of Manvantarani. And it's all pointing towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it indicates the histories of the Manus and other saintly kings who ruled during the Manus' reigns, and also the histories of other saintly people who lived during those periods and who received the Supreme Lord's special favor. So, of course, there are many stories like that about the great devotees, like Narada, how he got the mercy of the Lord. He's a saintly person. He received the Lord's special favor. So Manvantarani, in other words, is pointing towards that tenth subject, the Lord. The deeds of these saints are themselves religious standards, especially the Saddharma, the transcendental religion of worshipping the Lord. With regard to universal maintenance, uti, or impetuses for action, are desires for various fruitive activities. So there are different accounts of how people get entangled in fruitive activities and fall down from Krishna consciousness, like Ajamil, for example. Fruitive activity. But then he's saved by the Lord. So these descriptions about fruitive activities, they're also pointing us to the Lord or to the tenth subject. Ishanu Katar, narrations about the Lord, are historical accounts of the Lord's pastimes and his various incarnations, as well as accounts of his faithful followers' activities, Nrisinga, Varaha, Kurama, Matsya. They're all described. That's Ishanu Katar. And 57.3, the merging of the living entity along with his conditioning with the mystic lying down of Mahavishnu is called the winding up of the cosmic manifestation, the Nirodha or annihilation. So that's also described. And liberation, mukti, is the ninth subject. But this is here, the verse itself, or this line from the verse, is a very important line. Muktir hitvanyata rupam swarupena vyavastiti. That mukti, what is really mukti, means swarupena vyavastiti, that you get situated in your swarup. That is really mukti. In other words, not just impersonal liberation. So when the ninth subject is given as mukti, it doesn't mean impersonal mukti. It means, he says, liberation mukti is the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross, and subtle material bodies. Okay. So that is the fourth of these seven verses which are describing the ten topics. And these four have described the first nine. So then, a little bit of detail. When annihilation occurs, after a period of universal maintenance, Lord Hari goes to sleep, and the jivas follow him along with their energies, their upadis. This is called Nirodha, winding up. Lord Hari's going to sleep consists of his closing his eyes to the material creation, and the jivas going to sleep consists of their merging into Lord Hari. So they're two different experiences, although they're called the same thing. But for the Lord, he just goes into internal consciousness. But the jivas, they go into deep sleep, merge into the Lord. Everything is suspended altogether. If a jiva in that merged state has freed himself from his false acquired nature, the ignorance and other qualities superimposed on him by material illusion, he attains his original nature, and this is called mukti, or liberation, his original nature, swarup. That is the real form. It's the real rupa. Muktir hitvanyata rupam. That is the real form of mukti. So there, we can see how these nine topics, as Jiva Goswami said, they are clearly pointing us to the tenth topic. In all cases and always. So now, verse 58 is a short verse, just introducing the tenth topic. And it quotes the fifth of these seven verses from the tenth chapter of the second canto. The Supreme One, who is celebrated as the Supreme Being or the Supreme Soul, is the supreme source of the cosmic manifestation, as well as its reservoir and winding up. Thus, he is the supreme fountainhead, the absolute truth. So in that verse, if you look at the Sanskrit there, in the second line of the Sanskrit, it says, Sa Ashraya Parambrahma Paramatmeti Shabdyate. So that person, Sa, he
is the Ashraya, the shelter. He is the Param Brahma, the Supreme Brahman. He is the Super Soul. Iti Shabdyate. He is known thus. He is known like that. So here, of course, the Bhagavan feature is not mentioned. Anyway, let us read what Jiva Goswami says, though. In this verse, the abhash, the appearance, is the material creation, and the nirodha, cessation, is its dissolution. So he is the source of that, abhash and nirodha. The word yata refers to the one from whom the creation emanates, by whom it is made perceivable to the jiva's senses, adya vasiyate, and in whom it is dissolved. That renowned fountainhead of existence, the ashraya, is known as Brahman, as the verse says, and Paramatma, as the verse also says, Supersoul. But here the word iti expresses the idea of a complete category, thus implying that Bhagavan. So Bhagavan is implied, because we know from 1 to 11, which we've already discussed, Vedanti tat tat vavadas tatvam yajgyanam advayam, that advaya gyan, that very absolute truth, which we are talking about here specifically, is known as Brahman, Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, and Bhagavaniti, Shabdyate. Yeah, same thing. Same thing. So Bhagavan is necessarily implied. And although he's not mentioned here, but that means the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is included as well. And later we shall explain the Ashraya in detail. Later means in the next verse. Next two verses, actually. So there, I think it's very clear. I think it's very clear that the first nine subjects are simply serving the tenth subject, actually. That's their position. They're simply there to clarify the tenth subject. And the tenth subject is the real subject, the actual essence, that non-dual consciousness, that absolute reality, which is the cause of all causes, and the fountainhead of everything, the shelter of everything. When everything is wound up, it goes into him like this. Okay, so now I think we'll go on to this next section. It's two verses. It's not so long. I don't know, maybe we won't finish it, but we can at least start it because we have time. It's a very interesting process he goes through to make it clear to us what is that ashraya, what is that tenth subject, just so we don't get confused and think it's something else, like the jiva, for example, or like the demigods, perhaps, or like the material body, even. Yeah. So he is going to discuss, he's going to draw out the distinct nature of that absolute ashraya, who is his own support, his own shelter, and who is not supported or sheltered by anything else, but is supporting and sheltering everything else. Even those other things which some people might think could be possibly the shelters. This is the idea. It's a bit philosophical, actually. So let us go into then text 59. So this subsection is called Shukadeva's Understanding of the Tenth Topic, the Absolute Truth, as the shelter of all shelters, who is his own shelter. 59.1. Shukadev Goswami next discusses the divisions of adhyatmic, adhidaivic, and adhibhautik. He does this to clarify the nature of the ashraya, which he describes by referring to the direct common experience of the individual microcosm. So we're back into the vyashti, individual sort of perspective here. Now, the adhyatmic entity, Purusha, actually. In fact, they're referred to as Purushas in these two verses, which we're going to be reading the translation of shortly. Adhyatmic means the jiva. Adhidaivic means the demigods, and not just the demigods, but it's the demigods in a very specific sense. The demigods in the sense that they supply our sensory capabilities. The demigods supply our sense of sight, our sense of hearing, and all the other sensory functions. They're coming from the demigods. They're not coming from the jiva. They're being given to the jiva. Yeah? Anyway, that's okay. The point is still really the same. Anyway, that's okay. It's all happening under the direction of Yamaraj for them. Yeah. But the principle is the same. That there are persons who are controlling our sensory functions, and they're not us. Therefore, even though you've got eyes, you may go blind. Even though you've got ears, you may be deaf. And so on. So there's a sensory potency. It's being given, taken away, or, you know, like as you get older, your sensory capacities reduce. So, you know, they may either just be taken away like that, suddenly you lose your sight, or over a period of time, your sight may slowly fail. This is adhidaivic. And then adhibhautik means the body. These are three purushas, three persons, three entities. Adhyatmic means the jiva. Adhidaivic means the demigods in the sense of how they control our sensory capabilities. And adhibhautik means the body. The body. In which the jiva and the senses become united. The jiva and the demigods, in other words, they become united in the body. Which is going to be explained in the verse, in these two verses, which again, these verses are simply following on. They're simply following on. This is a whole series of verses from the beginning of the listing out of the 10 topics very briefly, right through to here. This is just one series of verses addressing these 10 topics. Okay, so here we go. These two verses then, next two verses from Srimad Bhagavatam. This adhyatmic purusha is the same as the adhidaivic purusha. Hare Krishna. Anyway, it's not so hard to understand. And he who creates the differentiation between these two is called the adhibhautik purusha. In the absence of any one of these, we do not perceive the other two. He who knows these three is the Lord, the Ashraya, who, being independent of everything else, is the support of his own self and them, and is the true Ashraya. I think let's just go and read the next part, because it's going to be addressing these matters further. 59.2. The jiva, the seer, who identifies himself as the owner of his eyes and other senses, is the adhyatmic person. He is indeed also the adhidaivic person, the sun and other deities presiding over the eyes and other senses. Before the physical body is created, the senses have nowhere to reside and so cannot act. Consequently, at this point, the adhyatmic and adhidaivic persons are indistinguishable from each other. Since there has yet to appear a distinction between the functions of the ordinary jivas, who consider themselves independent actors, and the illuminators of their senses and the deities who help them. And that person, so the jivas then, they consider themselves independent actors, and they consider themselves the illuminators of their senses. But really it's the demigods. The jivas can't do it without the demigods. And that person, because of whom there arises the conception of duality between the presumed owner of the senses and their presiding deities, is called adhibhautik, the visible body consisting of the eyeball and other physical sense organs. This physical body is said to be a person, quote-unquote, because it is an upadi, superimposed upon the real person, the jiva. The Shruti states, this, the adhibhautik person, consists of food and vital fluid, so that's our body. Okay, so, you know, it's not that hard, really, but you just got to think a little bit. So you've got this adhyatmic, the jiva, adhidaivic, demigod, sensorily empowered entity, and adhibhautik, these three persons. So the sort of funny thing that he said, apparently, is that the adhyatmic person and the adhidaivic person are the same. Now, they're the same. It's only in the sense, it's explained, really, in 59.1, in the two verses, and in 59.2, it's explained that when there is no body, then the jiva and his sensory capabilities, they're not really clearly independent of each other. Only when the living entity gets a body, only when he gets the body do the senses really function. And is the jiva really able to function? When there is no gross body, then the jiva cannot function. Even though he is in a conditioned state. Conditioned state means he has got these capacities in terms of his karma, maybe kind of attached to him. Sensory capabilities may be attached to him, or he may be attached to them, actually. But without a body, the conditioned soul cannot function because he's conditioned. He cannot function in a pure spiritual sense. When he becomes liberated, then he can function in a pure spiritual sense. But while conditioned, he has to have a body. Otherwise, he becomes dysfunctional, actually. And he cannot, it's not clear who he is, and whether these sensory capabilities are him, his own capabilities, or something else. But when you get the body, then it becomes clear that you are the jiva, and that these sensory capabilities are being given or taken away by the demigods, like this. Now, he did say that these three, they need each other. If the jiva does not have senses, the conditioned soul does not have a set of senses and a body through which those senses can function and he can function, then the conditioned soul becomes non-functional. He cannot do anything. Then if the demigods, in the sense of supplying sensory capabilities, if they have no one to supply sensory capabilities to, then they can't function. And the body, if it has no jiva, And even if it has a jiva, if it doesn't have sensory capabilities, then it can also not function. Do you get the idea? Are you with us? Is anyone lost here? Well, that's a good example. Yeah. The sun, the seeing power, and the body, which is seeing power. Yeah, the eyes, the actual organ as such. So even any two of them without the other one cannot function. What to speak of one without the anyone, without the other two? So, you know, in a sense, therefore, in a certain sense, you could say that all three of them are ashrayas for the others. In a sense, it's a very limited sense. This is actually going to be discussed in verse 60, which I suspect we're going to just read tomorrow. Anyway, we'll see how it goes, but so we don't want to overload your brains. Well, we're going to do, yeah, we'll probably finish tomorrow and then on Thursday we'll revise. So, I hope you understand this point. We're talking about Ashraya. The reason he's mentioned these three is because some people may think that any one or two or even all three of them may actually be the Ashraya, like that ultimate Ashraya. But he is trying to show, he is in the middle of the process of trying to show how they are definitely not the not one of them, not two, not even all three are the ultimate Ashraya. Every single one of them may give some shelter to the others. You understand how we're using the term shelter here? That the body is giving the jiva shelter. Because without the body, the jiva, you know, a conditioned soul without a body is just in limbo altogether. No, it's not even a ghost. It's not even a ghost. It doesn't have any body. Yeah, it's worse than a ghost. It's nowhere. It has no position. A jiva without a body. You know, we may say, oh, these bodies, they're material bodies. We don't like these bodies. You know, that idea. But a jiva without a body can do nothing, can do less than he can with a body. Yeah. So therefore the body is a shelter. In a very limited sense, the body is a type of shelter for the jiva and for the senses. But then you can turn it around and say that the body without the jiva, what is a body without a jiva? It's also nothing. It has no position of any meaning. Can't do anything. So the body is a type of shelter for the jiva, but the jiva is a type of shelter for the body. And then you've got the sensory capabilities, the power to see, the power to hear, and so on, which are given by the demigods, so naturally, no, you cannot separate them from the demigods. So therefore, the presiding deities, the demigods, they are also giving shelter to the jivas, giving shelter to the bodies, but they are also being sheltered by them. Because if there were no bodies to put their sensory powers into, then their sensory powers would have no place to go. They would also be basically nowhere, in some sort of limbo position. You follow the idea? So they're all giving some shelter. Actually, this is going to be described in verse 60. Some limited shelter to each other. But they're also being sheltered. So therefore, none of them could be called that real shelter. That's only the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's the only person who could be seen to be the real shelter. He shelters all three of them. They are all dependent upon him. But he has no shelter other than himself. So he is called Swashraya.